Okay, we'll move on now to talk about moral dilemmas and the way they're portrayed in literature. And we'll take a particular example, which has been much discussed in recent years, namely Herman Melville's Billy Budd. This is a story set at sea during the period of the French Revolutionary Wars, following the mutinies at Spithead and the Nore in 1797. And it concerns Billy Budd, a foretopman of HMS Bellipotent, or Indomitable, who is accused in the presence of his captain, Vere, of incitement to mutiny by the master-at-arms, Claggett. And this is a baseless charge. Claggett has it in for Budd. He is against him in some way. He feels a strong animosity towards him, for reasons that are speculated on in the story but never made entirely clear. And he is determined to bring Budd down, and this is the way he chooses to do so. Now, Budd, unfortunately, has a speech impediment, which is brought on in situations of stress, and that is what happens now, because Budd does not anticipate this charge at all. Although he's warned that Claggett has it in for him, he doesn't take it seriously because he can't see any reason why anyone should be against him. And he is therefore completely taken aback by this accusation and fails to respond in speech. His speech impediment strikes at that moment. And he finds that the only thing he can do is to lash out physically. And he strikes Claggett and kills him. And then the captain, Vere, who is present at this scene, is the only person present at it, convenes a drumhead court, which he persuades, in effect, and somewhat reluctantly, the reluctance both on his part and on the part of the fellow officers who make up the court, he persuades them that despite their reluctance, they must condemn Budd for striking a senior officer, because that is a capital offence under the Incitement to Mutiny Act 1797, recently introduced after the mutinies. So it seems, legally speaking, an open and shut case. The Incitement to Mutiny Act doesn't talk about motives or intention or anything like that. It's a strict liability offence, as the lawyers say. Striking a senior officer is a capital offence. So Vere persuades the others to condemn Budd to hanging, and the execution is carried out pretty swiftly in the early hours of the morning. And as I say, Vere and his fellow officers reach this decision, it's clear, reluctantly. The officers somewhat more so than Vere. But Vere feels the dilemma of the situation acutely. He seems to be caught between the demands of military duty on the one hand and of natural justice on the other. He describes Budd as innocent before God. It's clear that he believes Budd, who does manage to say a few words for himself in the trial that follows, and he states that Claggett lied in accusing him of mutiny, and Vere believes Budd. The officers obviously do as well, although they're clearly puzzled by the whole situation. Why should Claggett have made this completely false charge? What motive could he have had? And at the trial, certainly no light is shed on that. So Vere is caught in this dilemma between what seem to be the demands of military duty and natural justice. And Melville in the story makes it clear that, as I've been suggesting, Vere in effect over-persuades his fellow justices, who would have been inclined to a milder sentence. I mean, one option that was privately entertained by the ship's surgeon as meeting the case was to put Budd in solitary confinement until the ship rejoined the main fleet, and then Vere could have had a regular court-martial summoned under the presidency of the Admiral. But Vere decides that there isn't time to do this, that the situation is too dangerous. so that is why he decides not to wait. Bud himself was pressed into service. There are other men on the ship who were impressed. And in the light of the recent mutinies, Veer feels that he can't afford to take any risks. He has to show firmness and act swiftly, not show any sign of weakness. And it's made clear in the story that although Bud himself was not disaffected at all, there were others who were, or who might be. So that the threat of mutiny was not something that Veer could afford to take lightly. And his calculation, his reckoning, is that he must apply the law and apply it very quickly, not wait and give the impression of hesitancy. So Veer pushes the court towards a sentence of death, but it is clear that the incident remains with him for the rest of his life. He doesn't live very long after the story. In fact, we're told that he's killed in action at a later point of the French Revolutionary Wars, but he dies with the name of Billy Budd on his lips. We're told that he doesn't feel remorse at his decision, but it nevertheless continued to occupy him, to plague him, we might say. And that's, of course, a very natural touch on Melville's part. Anyone who makes a decision of that sort, even if you think you've made the right decision, you're not going to be able to put it down, as it were, mentally. And it's clear that that was the case with Veer. It was a very difficult, very serious dilemma. And the philosophers who've written about this story and used it as an example of a moral dilemma have varied quite a bit on whether they think Veer made the right decision, and if so, in what sense. Some people think it's clear from the story that he made the wrong decision, so that seems to be Wiggins's position, for example. And there is indeed some support for that in the story, not only in the facts that I've been relaying, namely that Veer tends to push the court towards a verdict of guilty and death, but also it's suggested that maybe he shows signs of possibly even of madness. So Wiggins thinks that Veer made the wrong decision. Other people have thought that he made the right decision. The article which really sparked most of the debate on this was written by Peter Winch, and he argues that Veer made the right decision for him, even though it would not necessarily have been the right decision for someone else. And Winch thinks that if he, Winch, had been in that position, he would not have been able to make the decision that Veer made. He would have felt that the demands of natural justice trumped the considerations of military duty. Now, the immediate difficulty with Winch's position is that it seems to run counter to a venerable principle, the principle of universalizability, which says that if it's right for a particular agent to do something in certain circumstances, then it would be right for any agent so circumstanced to do that thing. If it's wrong to do something, if it's wrong for a particular agent to do something in particular circumstances, then that would be so for any agent placed in those circumstances. What makes the action right or wrong must be universalizable to any agent similarly placed. The difference of agent can't make a moral difference, at least according to the usual traditional reading of the principle of universalizability. On the one hand, you've got the agent. On the other hand, you've got the circumstances in which that agent is placed. And if you don't vary the circumstances relevantly, morally relevantly, that is, then there's no basis on which different decisions by different agents can be justified. If it's right for you to do something in a particular situation, then if I'm in a relevantly similar situation, then I should do the same. The mere difference of agent, the fact that I'm me and you're you, that does not amount to a morally relevant consideration. That's the principle of universalizability and the traditional interpretation of it. And one question is whether Winch's view is in breach of that principle, and then the next question is, if it is, does that matter? Maybe the principle is wrong and should be jettisoned anyway. And in effect, Winch himself seems to argue that this is not actually an exception to the principle, strictly understood, because the boundary that I was setting up there in my description of the principle of universalizability between agent and circumstances is not so rigid as I was making out. This is, in effect, Winch's point, that the boundary is fluid. Some aspects of the agent may be part of the circumstances, so may fall on that side of the divide. If we continue to maintain a distinction between the agent placed in the circumstances and the circumstances themselves, then in effect, and I'm saying in effect because this is not precisely the way Winch himself makes the point, but one way of putting what he's saying, I think, is to say, well, yes, there is that boundary between agent and circumstance, but it's a fluid one. It's not rigid and fixed. And what that means is that some aspects of a person's character, say, that you might have wanted instinctively to put on the agent side of the divide between agent and circumstance, maybe actually should be put on the circumstance side of the divide. So that an agent's character becomes a morally relevant circumstance, becomes morally relevant to the decision. And if that's so, then maybe the way to put Winch's point would be to say, well, Vere's character was relevant to the decision that he reached. Winch's presumably rather different character would be relevant to the decision, morally relevant to the decision that he reached if he were placed in similar circumstances. Similar external circumstances, that is. And their characters are different, so that the total circumstances are different. So that even if you matched the external circumstances, you, as it were, managed to transport Winch in a time machine back onto the Indomitable and put him in Vere's position or onto another ship in a very similar position, in a very similar conflict. You know, no matter how well you managed to match the external circumstances, you wouldn't be able to match the total circumstances, because belonging to those total circumstances are the agent's own characters. And those are going to be very different in this particular case, because these two people, Vere and Winch, have very different backgrounds, upbringings, expectations, aims, ambitions, and so on, motivations. And if we assume that that is all at least kept fixed, then if we also put that into that kind of thing into the circumstance of the action, put it onto the circumstance side of the divide between agent and circumstance, then of course we won't have any exception to the principle of universalizability, because the circumstances will be different. Vere's circumstances will not be the same as Winch's circumstances, because Vere's character is not the same as Winch's character, and we're putting character into circumstance. So then the example will simply be irrelevant to the principle of universalizability. It won't constitute a counterexample to it. It will have moved the circumstances, will have varied the circumstances, and of course the principle doesn't make any prediction or lay down any rule at all for what happens in if the circumstances are varied. It only says that if the circumstances are not varied, or not relevantly varied, then the decisions reached should be the same regardless of agent. That's all the principle says. But if we're now saying that, well, part of the agent's character is actually morally relevant, is a morally relevant feature of the circumstance, then if you have two very different agents trying to reach decisions in what look like, externally speaking, very similar circumstances, nevertheless, those will be totally considered different circumstances because the agent's characters will be different. So the situation, as I say, will no longer be any kind of threat to the principle of universalizability. It simply won't be relevant to that principle. So as I say, I'm putting things in rather different terms from the ones Winch himself uses, but I don't think I'm falsifying what he says. That's at least my understanding of, in effect, what he's doing. Now, there's one important respect in which he goes, I think, a bit further than what I've just said, and that is that he thinks that, well, I've been talking about the agent's character. What Winch says is that it's the agent's tendency to make a particular decision. The agent feels a nisus, a tendency to make a particular decision, feels drawn to making a particular decision. I mean, that's obviously, one gets that strongly with Veer from the story, but I mean, this point is a general one, that when agents are in moral dilemmas or in any kind of situation in which they have to decide, they often find themselves naturally drawn to one side of the question. Now, that's presumably a function of one's character. That's going to be connected with one's character. So this is why I don't think my way of describing Winch's position, it falsifies it in any essential way. But what he really says is that it's the decision itself that has to be, in a sense, reckoned into the circumstances rather than the agent's character. So that there's a kind of bootstrapping effect here. The fact that you find yourself drawn to a particular decision is then itself a feature of the situation that has to be taken into account. And in itself, in some sense, justifies, this is Winch's view, the decision that you reach. The fact that you find yourself drawn to a particular decision can, in some sense, justify that very decision. So what he says is that it's not the case that finding out what the right thing to do is and deciding to do it are two different processes. That's the position he's opposing, which was taken up by Sidgwick. He refers to Sidgwick as thinking that the decision is one thing, the finding out quite another, whereas he wants to say, this is on page 165 of his article, deciding what to do is in itself a sort of finding out what the right thing to do is. Now, Winch is aware that that kind of position is, I mean, one obvious objection to it is that it's open to abuse. You can more or less justify any decision at all on that basis. If somebody says, well, why did you do that? And what's your justification for doing that? It can't be good enough for you just to reply, well, that's a decision I felt like making. I found myself drawn to making that decision. So that's a justification, basta. No. And Winch is aware of this problem, that his solution or his view can easily appear too facile, appear to justify any decision at all, just by virtue of the fact that it's that decision that is made. But of course, he wants his position to be, and it is, more sophisticated than that. So it's not simply a matter of the decision, as it were, bootstrapping its own justification into existence, full stop, nothing more to be said. It's obviously got to be contextualized, the whole thing. And we have to put in certain safeguards. For example, we have to ensure that the agent making the decision is fully morally aware. So is morally aware of the moral aspects of the situation, is a reflective person, is thinking the matter through, and so on. Things like that. So it's not just a sort of knee-jerk reaction where you find yourself in a moral dilemma and you, as it were, toss a mental coin and then say, well, that's my decision, and according to Peter Winch, a decision justifies itself, so end of story. No, there's got to be a lot more to it than that. But his idea is really that if in the situation in which he's placed, given everything about him, given the sort of person he is, so this is where character comes in, Veer finds that one decision comes naturally to him and that the other decision would be deeply unnatural for him, then that itself is a justifying factor. Now, in ordinary situations, we do often actually reason in a similar way to that. We often, you know, we hear advice to people like, you know, do what your heart tells you, do what you feel comfortable with, don't do something if you feel you couldn't live with the decision. And these pieces of advice are very close to what Winch is saying, because in effect, pieces of advice like that are saying, well, your character, the sort of person you are, is relevant to the decision you make. And helps to determine whether you make the right decision or not. You've got to make a decision that you can live with, we say. Well, what does that mean exactly? It means you've got to make a decision in accordance with your own character, because if you don't, you will get out of sync with your own character and things won't work out. You'll find yourself unhappy. You'll be like a square peg in a round hole. You'll be doing something which you find unnatural, which doesn't come naturally to you. And of course, we advise people and people advise us not to do that. That's not a good idea. Now, I mean, these decisions are often life decisions, important decisions, but they're not necessarily decisions like Veer's decision, which is a moral dilemma and involves the lives of other people. You know, so you might say, well, yes, the winch sort of position is all very well if you're wondering whether to be a surgeon or a circus clown. If you're wondering what to do with your life, you're wondering what sort of career to pursue, then the advice, do what comes naturally to you, is, of course, very good advice. But, you know, if you're a judge in a capital trial and you have the power of life or death over somebody, and you just can't decide, you're having difficulty deciding, say. I mean, in that situation, you might think, well, it's a bit odd to, you know, for somebody to say to you, well, do what you feel comfortable with. I mean, you know, it seems a bit flippant. But in effect, Winch is saying that, I mean, one way of putting his point would be to say, well, the moral situation, no matter how serious, how severe it is, so even if it is a life and death situation like the one that Veer is in, it's continuous with the much less weighty circumstances in which we do say to somebody, well, do what you're comfortable with, do what comes naturally. If you find yourself wanting to do something, then that'll be the right thing for you. You know, the sorts of situations in which we say that to somebody may well be morally relatively trivial, but Winch's point would be, I think, that it's continuous with morally serious situations. So although that might be a rather flippant thing to say in context, if one of Veer's fellow officers said to Veer, well, look, you know, do what you feel comfortable with, apart from the fact that that's not, of course, 18th century idiom, it would sound rather flippant, unequal to the gravity of the situation. But, you know, we could think of more serious formulations of the point. And the point would be that Veer's own character and his own tendencies to make particular decisions in particular ways are, in effect, part of the morally relevant circumstances. So that a decision can be right for Veer, which would be wrong for Winch, given the difference between their characters. And I think a point on Winch's side from the story is this. I mean, you might say, well, hold on a minute, we're talking about the administration of justice here. And in a capital case, that's a very serious matter. We can't have it turning on the individual character of the judge. I mean, that would be ridiculous. You know, it'd be absurd if Bud could read Winch's paper. You know, impossibly enough, but if he could, and then entertain the thought, well, I'm up before Captain Veer, so I'm going to be condemned because he's that kind of man. What a shame I'm not up before Peter Winch as my judge, because he would let me off, because he's that kind of man. And you might say, well, you know, surely the administration of justice should be aiming a bit higher than that. People shouldn't be being condemned or acquitted on the basis of the characters of the judge. Surely it should be much more objective than that. And really, whoever the judge is, I mean, ideally speaking, you might say, it shouldn't matter who the judge is. Whoever the judge is, that person should reach the same decision as everyone else if he or she is doing the job properly, paying attention properly to the evidence and applying the law correctly. There shouldn't be variation between different judges on the basis of personal character. And of course, that is a legal ideal, no question about it. But the reason why I'm mentioning this point is that I think in the story itself, we do get a sense from the trial and the scenes afterwards of a very personal element in the decision, which Billy Budd accepts. In the trial, there's a point at which he, as it were, puts his fate in Veer's hands. One of the officers asks him a question, namely, why should Claggett have lied in this terrible way? And Budd is at a loss to answer it. He simply can't answer it. And he turns to Vere, and Vere speaks on his behalf. And from then on, it's as though Budd consigns himself, consigns his life and his happiness and his fortunes to Vere's charge and trusts him like a father figure. There's a sense in which Vere is a father figure to Budd. And there's a sense in which Budd turns himself over to the decision of Vere, whatever it is, and accepts that. And he goes to his death saying, "God bless Captain Vere." And it's as though he recognises that this is actually quite a personal decision that has been made. Other people might not have made it in the same way, but Vere has made it in this way, and that's partly because of the man he is. And it's as if Budd accepts that. So I don't want to build too much on this because I don't think it's a major part of the story, but I do think there's a slight hint of a personalisation of the decision towards the end, so that it's not simply a matter of a mechanical application of military law. So it's almost as if, to put it even more explicitly, it's almost as if Budd, in some sense, knows that Vere's made the decision or pushed the court towards a particular decision. Other men might not have done that, but Vere has done what he has done and Budd accepts it, even though he knows that there's a kind of a personal element to it, and therefore, in a sense, from a legal point of view, an arbitrary element to it. So there is a sense in which he is suffering arbitrary justice, but he accepts that. Now, Wiggins takes the view that Vere, as it were, is not allowed to hold certain aspects of his character fixed as part of the situation, so that although in principle he agrees with Winch that that sort of situation could arise, it could be the case that an agent's character was relevant to the decision that one should make in a moral dilemma. So in principle, I think he agrees with Winch's position, but he doesn't himself think that the Vere example really illustrates it, because it's clear he thinks that Vere made the wrong decision. And unlike Winch, he doesn't think that Vere is really entitled to hold his character as a military commander fixed, and as it were, part of the circumstances in which the decision is made. Wiggins's view is that that should be up for grabs as well. That's something that Vere should be prepared to reflect on. So, to quote Wiggins, this is from page 180, he says that Vere is not entitled to treat his own character and his duty and function as a naval captain holding the King's commission and his view of that duty and function as among the realities, so the non-negotiable realities. For the purposes of the future, i.e. the decision, from then on even these things needed reappraisal. End of quote. So Wiggins is in effect saying, well, Vere's not allowed simply to say, look, I am a naval commander, this is the law, naval commanders apply the law, so end of story. I mean, not that Vere does say that, but that is certainly a way some people would have reasoned in his situation. He's not entitled to say that, says Wiggins, because he should reappraise these aspects of his background and character. Maybe he should consider... You see, I mean, if Vere didn't act as he does, and if the consequences turned out badly, so suppose there were a mutiny on board the ship because there was sufficient disaffection among the men and they sensed that their officers were weak, not willing to punish a mutineer, somebody who'd been accused of mutiny, if they saw that and that emboldened them to take action and there was a mutiny, well then Vere himself, if assuming he survived, would be very, very severely punished for that by the Admiralty. And he's aware of that. He's aware of those consequences, those potential consequences. I mean, that's not played up in the story at all. It's not suggested that he acts in any way selfishly. He's not thinking about his own commission and his possible loss of it. But that could be among the consequences of a wrong decision at this stage. But he is wanting to avoid serious consequences, mutiny and similar things, not simply for himself, but from everyone's point of view, he takes himself to be acting in the general interests of the war effort of the Navy. So Wiggins is really adopting a very idealistic position, you might say, or unrealistic if you were being less charitable, that somebody in Vere's position can't simply rest upon the fact that he is a naval commander with certain duties. He may get into situations where he has to reappraise that and to say, well, I can't consistently, with honour or with morality, do what my duty would command me to do, so I must put down my commission, I must put down my command, and take whatever consequences follow. You know, my conscience is above my duty, as it were, my military duty, and I'm not prepared to condemn a man to death who is basically innocent, even though he has committed this offence, but he has an underlying innocence, and I know that. I'm not prepared to condemn him to death. That would be an infringement of natural justice, and if that means that I have to relinquish my command of this ship, leave the Navy, court-martial, whatever it means, I will take those consequences because that is the right thing to do. Wiggins is, as I say, very idealistically asking this of Vere. Well, okay. My own feeling is that it's not unreasonable to make that demand. Of course, we do make that demand of soldiers, that they think above the level of military duty. At least we expect that of them in certain situations. But I think if you put that point to Vere, he would reply in some of the terms that I've used and say, well, this would solve nothing. I mean, suppose I do release Bud, or suppose I don't impose the law immediately, I risk mutiny, and if that happens, then that is in nobody's interests. I think that is how he would respond, and he would say, we need to avoid that situation, perhaps not at all costs, but at any rate, in this situation, the law is clear, and it is unfortunate that it has to be applied to somebody who is, as it were, fundamentally innocent, but he's not actually innocent of the crime of which he's charged, and that is a capital crime. So we have to apply the law, we have to be seen to do it, and that is in everyone's best interests. I mean, to put it in slightly extreme terms, not condemning Bud might seem in the short term to be the right thing to do in point of natural justice, but if the consequence of that were that a lot of other people, maybe including Bud himself, were killed as a result of mutinous action, then in retrospect, I think we would say that Vere had made the wrong decision. So those are the sorts of considerations that are on his mind. He's not simply saying to himself, look, I am a naval captain and this is what naval captains do. His reasoning is much subtler, more sophisticated than that, as Melville makes clear. So I think Wiggins's appraisal of the situation is mistaken. But his discussion does raise a very interesting point, which is that we need to ask ourselves to what extent it's feasible or coherent for an agent to put aspects of his or her character into the circumstance side of the divide that I was talking about earlier between agent and action. Agent and circumstance. So you've got this principle of universalizability, which says that if you plonk an agent into a circumstance, then if you plonk any other agent into a morally similar circumstance, then these agents ought to behave in the same way. That's what morality requires. There shouldn't be a difference. The mere difference of agent can't make a moral difference. And if the circumstances, which of course can make a moral difference, but if they are morally similar, relevantly similar, then there is no difference and the agents should act in the same way. So that's what the principle of universalizability is saying. And then the subtlety we've been considering, really, which the story gives rise to, is the thought, well, maybe some aspects of an agent's character should be considered as part of the circumstance. So as something that can vary the circumstance relevantly, so that if two different agents who have two different characters are put into circumstances which, from an external point of view, are relevantly similar, nevertheless, the fact that the agent's characters are different and the fact that we're reckoning their characters as part of the circumstance means that the total circumstances are different. So if they act in different ways, we no longer have a breach of the principle of universalizability. That's the sort of subtlety we've been thinking about. And now the risk of that kind of strategy is that if we put too much of the agent's character onto the circumstance side of the divide, we won't have anything left on the agent side to make the decision or do the acting. We will be left with a kind of, ultimately, we will be left with a transcendental self, a self that is stripped of empirical properties because they've all been put onto the circumstance side of the divide. And of course, that's a transcendental self is a monstrosity, is an absurdity, is not something that can actually make any decisions or act in the real world. An agent capable of making decisions and acting in the real world must be an entity with some kind of empirical oomph to it, that's to say, some kind of empirical character, qualities. There must be something solid there that can actually make the decision and act. So we can't simply shunt all aspects of an agent's character onto the circumstance side of the divide and treat them as part of the circumstance. I mean, for one thing, that would, of course, trivialise the principle of universalizability, which is meant to have more bite than that. If all aspects of an agent's character were part of the circumstance, and if on the agent side of the divide we were just left with this stripped self, this transcendental self, this locus of pure thought and action, as it were, incoherent though it is, if that was the way we were conceiving of the agent, then clearly any difference in character then would make a difference in circumstance, so that we would never find ourselves with any challenge to the principle of universalizability, but by the same token it would have lost all bite. It would be entirely trivial. Any time anyone said, well, this is what so-and-so did in that situation, you find yourself in the same situation, so you should do the same thing, you would be able to reply, well, so-and-so has a different character, and the character is relevant to the circumstance one finds oneself in. Because my character is different, that means that that situation is not relevant to this one, because it's different, morally relevantly different. So it gives no guidance as to how I should act. Each situation would be almost unique. One wouldn't be able to make any kind of transferences or inferences from one situation to another. But we think we can do that, and the point of the principle of universalizability is to sort of regiment what's going on there, give us a structure to our thinking, and we don't want it to be entirely trivial. But anyway, quite apart from that point about universalizability, the essential objection to the strategy of locating all the agent's properties on the circumstance side of the divide between agent and circumstance is that you would then be left with something on the agent side, a locus of pure thought and action, as I put it earlier, which wouldn't be recognisable as a real agent at all. A real agent has got to have some empirical character. So you can't simply transfer and treat as aspects of the circumstance all aspects of an agent's character. At least, and this is a crucial point, you can't do it for all simultaneously. But maybe what we can say is that any aspect of an agent's character can be held fixed and treated as part of the circumstance, the non-negotiable circumstance, as it were. But not all aspects simultaneously. Maybe that's the correct position. So Wiggins is right that Veer could, as it were, look on objectively his naval status, his background as a naval commander, and think whether he is prepared, as it were, to lose all that, prepared to act out of that character by not condemning Budd. So he could, as it were, distance himself from that aspect of his character and his past. But he couldn't distance himself from all aspects of his character and his past simultaneously. There's got to be somewhere for him to stand in order to make the judgment that Wiggins wants him to make, which is, yes, the claim of natural justice here matters more than my status as a naval commander. I mean, apart from anything else, he's got to be an agent to whom the appeal to natural justice speaks. If he's just a locus of pure thought and action, as it were, with no empirical qualities, then nothing is going to appeal to him, or it, as we should say. Appeals of natural justice will just get nowhere with such a locus of pure thought, because there's nothing empirical there for it to engage with. Why should natural justice matter to a transcendental self? Why should it matter more than anything else? Nothing would matter to a transcendental self. So to sort of act in the way that Wiggins would like Veer to act. Veer would have to say something like, well, yes, I am deeply committed to the Navy. It's my career, it's my life, and applying military law is part of that, and I've done it many times, and here's another situation. But look, I'm also deeply committed to justice, to natural justice, to people getting their just deserts. I have ideals there. And I'm, as it were, going to stand on those ideals. I'm going to rest on them as a position from which to make a judgment about what to do and from which to put my own naval past and background into perspective and the whole business of applying military law into perspective. And I'm going to say, well, on this particular occasion, I'm not going to apply military law because the demands of natural justice are higher. That's, in effect, what Wiggins is asking Veer to say, and that's something that one could say. People have said that. They do say that on occasion. You can relinquish something that has hitherto mattered a great deal to you. You can come to judge that it, in this situation, mustn't count at all. But you can only do that if you can rest on something else that matters to you and that you decide or see matters to you even more than this aspect of your character and past. You've got to make the decision from somewhere. You can't make it from nowhere. And you've got to make it from, as it were, a firmer base, what you come to see as a firmer base for making that decision. So that Veer would, in effect, be identifying himself with an aspect of his character, in one aspect of his character, his passion for natural justice, in order to negate, to discount another aspect of his character, that's to say his passion for military service, for naval command, for his loyalty to all that entails, including military law. And as I say, that is something that somebody can do, but in order to avoid this fantasy of the transcendental self, we need to ensure that the self that makes the decision is empirically rich, as it were, not empirically poor, so that you may be able to, as it were, suspend or discount or negate any particular aspect of your character, but you couldn't do that to all aspects of your character simultaneously. There must be somewhere for you to stand when you make that decision. So, as I say, I think the Wiggins position does make sense, or can be made to make sense, provided we, as I say, avoid this absurdity of the transcendental self, but I think we can avoid that. So in general terms, I think that's okay. But I do think, as I said, that Wiggins's position on Veer's choice is a little simplistic in the sense that he casts it as a dilemma between the demands of natural justice on the one hand and the rigours of military duty on the other. And that is too simple. And I think if you put it to Veer in those terms, it's clear from the story that he would say that it's not as simple as that, for the reasons that I've given. There are wider repercussions to be considered. We're in a context here, a context which includes recent mutinies, which includes a dangerous enemy, always lurking round the corner, as it were. We can't afford mutinies. We have to avoid them, so that the demands of natural justice themselves are not as individualistic as Wiggins is making out. It's not simply a case of executing Bud is a contravention of natural justice. Natural justice demands that that execution not be carried out. It's not as simple as that. You have to consider possible ramifications, and of course you're acting in a state of uncertainty, but you have to make predictions about likely consequences, and that is something that Veer is doing. And you can't simply, in the sort of situation that he's in, you can't simply, or it would be wrong, simply to say, oh, look, we must consider this one individual case in abstraction from all possible consequences. To hell with the consequences. We need to consider the innocence of this man in abstraction from all other issues and simply be guided by that. And if the heavens fall down as a consequence, then so be it. No, that is not a way of thinking that anyone in Veer's situation, or indeed in most situations, can afford to take. And he wouldn't take that. And I don't know what Wiggins would say, whether he would persist and say, no, he should take that regardless of the consequences. But my view is that Vere is right to consider possible consequences of different courses of action, as I think he does, and take that into account in making his decision. So that it's not a simple clash between military duty and natural justice. And of course, the reason for that is that the considerations on the military duty side are there for a reason. It's not just a sort of an arbitrary law that has been passed. It's been passed for a reason. Maybe misguided, that's another question, but the law has been passed with the intention of preventing further mutiny. And a mutiny is an event in which considerations of justice go overboard. A lot of unjust things happen in a mutiny. A lot of people who don't deserve it get killed or wounded. So that considerations of natural justice have to take into account the consequences of different courses of action and the likelihood or the possibility that particular courses of action might induce a mutiny. And that's something that the law is, whether you think it's right or wrong, that's something that the law is trying to engage with. So that considerations of natural justice fall on both sides of the dilemma. They don't fall simply on one side, as Wiggins makes out. That in itself doesn't settle the matter, but it makes it more complicated than one might initially be inclined to think. And it may, not only Wiggins, but I think Winch is slightly inclined to think of this dilemma in a rather simplistic way as well. I think, you know, both Wiggins and Winch are inclined to say, look, Bud is fundamentally innocent. And that's really the only morally relevant fact in this situation. Nothing else matters beside that. And that is, it's that point that Vere doesn't accept. And in my view, he's right not to accept it. The situation is more complicated than that. That doesn't necessarily mean that he made the right decision, but I don't think he can be faulted for ignoring considerations of justice in order to obey military duty in some kind of neutral sense or non-moral sense. The moral considerations, the considerations of justice, as I'm stressing, fall on both sides of the dilemma. That's what makes it such a difficult choice for him to make. Okay, I'll stop there.